Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, March 15th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Noah Asimov from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. This week, the Cape Cod Times is running a series of stories marking Sunshine Week, which is a national effort to draw attention to the importance of access to public records and open government. I want to start this week, Kristen, talking about your story on yesterday's front page about teacher misconduct and how it can escape detection, especially in individual teachers' history as they move from one job to another.
Yeah, so I took a look at this. We all know sort of there are those criminal background checks in place that are intended to prevent adults who might sexually abuse children from gaining access to students. But when you look at those laws, what they really require is for school employees to submit to a name-based criminal offender record information check, which most people know as a CORI. And that returns information about arraignments that are held against a person within the state of Massachusetts. They also have to pass a fingerprint-based check that returns information about arrests and possibly other incidents made in Massachusetts and other states. But the problem there is that states can have varying policies regarding what's reported and whether offenses can be sealed. And that really translates to a lack of consistency in what's included on the report from state to state. I also did speak with people who work in child advocacy, specifically with Jetta Bernier, who serves as the executive director for the Mass Citizens for Children, which is an advocacy group based out of Boston. And she said that another problem really is that sometimes people feel that although an individual might pass the fingerprint or other checks, that that means it's okay. But she said a large majority of those who abuse children have actually never been arrested or convicted, so their names might not come up on those types of searches. Jacob Stapleton, who's a community education and outreach coordinator for Children's Cove, which is based here on the Cape, said he knows of several situations where a person may have committed an offense while employed with one school district, but then either the investigation wasn't able to be substantiated or prosecuted, so information wasn't communicated to the next school district, and that person was able to gain employment at another school without the school being aware.
So some of these issues never elevate, you can say, to the level of a criminal investigation or something like that.
Yeah, so or they even don't... when they do, sometimes that if there's no if charges aren't able to be brought, there are ways that may not stick permanently to someone's record.
Then schools, what are they to do as they try to hire somebody? What are some of the steps that they can take to make sure that they're hiring somebody whose background doesn't include something like this?
Well, so the biggest thing that these advocates that I spoke with said was that hiring policies really need to go beyond the bare minimum checks. Schools need to have a thorough policy in place so that they're really vetting these candidates who are coming in roles that have direct contact with children. Those should include maybe broader national background checks, sex offender registry checks, because schools are really left when incidents occur and they don't rise to the level of charges that are prosecutable. Schools can be really left with sort of some discretion on how to handle that situation. Sometimes there have been individuals who have been caught or arrested for these things, and they've gone on record saying that they actually look for places that don't have solid policies and procedures in place. The handbooks for a lot of these schools are available online, and they've said they go through and look for places that have weak policy where they're less likely to be caught in doing some of these sorts of things.
And there are a couple of pieces of legislation that are being considered around this right now.
Yes, there are. So there are two bills that are currently pending on Beacon Hill, and those sponsored by Senator Joan Lovely out of Salem, and Julian Sear, actually, in Truro, is a co-sponsor on those bills. And what the bills are aiming to do is to make it tougher for teachers who've been investigated for sexual misconduct to move from one school district to another. They would exempt some of these investigations from personnel laws in the state that sort of tie the hands of school districts because they're not allowed to reveal some of this negative information about employees. by requiring hiring schools to request that information and requiring schools that are requested, that have received a request for information, to fulfill that request within 120 days. And what that would do is allow schools and basically make it mandatory for schools to pass along information about investigations. There is an exception, though, if those investigations were found to be false allegations, so that the teachers who are maybe innocent of these things don't have this tarnished record.
This is a great initiative, the Sunshine Week initiative by the Cape Cod Times, and each of these stories has a lot in it. We're going to talk about a couple more of the stories throughout the program. Right now, I want to talk about one of the big national stories this week, which had to do with the college admissions cheating scandal. And among the people charged here were three with Cape Cod connections.
Yes. So there were several men, as you mentioned, with Cape Cod connections that were charged as part of this scandal. One of them is 59-year-old John Wilson of Hyannisport. He is the CEO of the private equity and real estate development firm Hyannisport Capital. And he was charged with conspiracy to commit mail and honest services fraud. Also on the list is Gordon Ernst. He's a 52-year-old former head coach of the men and women's tennis teams at Georgetown University. And he's also the former executive director of Vineyard Youth Tennis on Martha's Vineyard. And he was indicted for conspiracy to commit racketeering. He lives in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and in Falmouth. The head sailing coach at Stanford University, who is also a Cape Cod Academy graduate, 41-year-old John Vandemore, also pleaded guilty Tuesday in U.S. District Court in Massachusetts to commit conspiracy to commit racketeering.
So one of the ways that this cheating scandal worked was that coaches at these universities were being bribed to accept students as if they were potential athletes, when in fact oftentimes they had no connection at all with that athletic program or doing anything like tennis or sailing that they were being considered for.
That's right. And that's sort of how these two, especially these two with Cape connections, were coaches at these schools. So Vandemore specifically, who in exchange for bribes would designate designate applicants as athletic recruits, even though, as you mentioned, they had no skill in that sport or in some cases didn't even play. In 2017, he agreed to designate a child who was applying, who was not a competitive sailor, as a recruit in exchange for payment to Stanford Sailing. Rick Singer, who's kind of the man at the center of this scandal, had mailed a $110,000 payment from one of his charitable accounts. He had these not-for-profits that were set up as not-for-profits but were actually transferring money involved in this scam. Those payments were sent to Stanford. The student ended up going to another university, and Vandemore agreed with Singer to use that same recruiting spot for another client in exchange for a $500,000 payment to the sailing program. That student had minimal sailing experience and didn't even apply to Stanford, but Singer then mailed another payment for $160,000 from one of his charities to the sailing program as a deposit for a future student. And Vandemore has since been fired from his job at Stanford.
Now, another of the fellows here is Gordon Ernst, who has a condominium in Falmouth, and he was a tennis instructor. He was actually tennis instructor to Michelle Obama, I believe. But he's been sort of swept into this as well, with accusations that he got people into a program who didn't even play tennis.
Yes, he has.
Competitively.
And he was allegedly paid more than $2.7 million by Singer. He bribed that amount between 2012 and 2018, and those fees were sort of written off as consulting fees. Singer typically made those payments to Ernst from his charitable organizations and sent them through the mail, and at one point they even came to Ernst's residence in Falmouth. In exchange, Ernst supposedly designated at least 12 applicants as recruits for the Georgetown tennis team, and that was what allowed them to get into the school, even though some of them didn't even play tennis. According to the documents, Ernst might be required to forfeit his property at 25 Gang Way in Falmouth, along with a country club membership in Maryland and $2.7 million. He's been released on $200,000 bond.
We're going to speak right now with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Noah, the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead Aquinnah is moving ahead with construction of a bingo hall on the island. There's been a lot of concern expressed from the community on this. The Martha's Vineyard Commission has been asking to meet with the tribe about it. Now the two sides did actually sit down this week in a private meeting. Tell us what we know about this.
Yes, so we know that a delegation from the commission and tribal leaders has finally met face-to-face. They've been asking for this for a while, but the meeting was private. It was a closed-door meeting. We know that it happened Wednesday at tribal headquarters, and the chairman and executive director of the commission were present. And then from the Wampanoag side, there was a delegation that was led by the tribal chairwoman, Cheryl Andrews-Maltese, and the Tribal Gaming Corporation. And then we know it lasted approximately 2 hours. And although we don't know what was said behind the closed doors, the two sides did release a joint press statement that basically said we had a very productive conversation and we want to have another one soon. It was a very short release.
Not a lot there. The town representatives, no town representatives were there.
No town representatives were there. Back in the town, construction is continuing, and the selectmen have been voicing their frustration about the lack of information available. They weren't at the meeting. They weren't invited to the meeting. They've sent a letter that has pretty much doubled down on their stance that kind of the peripheral elements of the project, like public safety and traffic, would be subject to review by the commission. They haven't received a reply, and so they're still kind of waiting.
For a little bit of background here, the tribe is moving ahead. Describe the size of what they're proposing here and what they're building.
Yes. Yeah, so what we know detail-wise is that the tribe, in their announcement when construction began, was that there was going to be a 10,000-square-foot facility. It's going to be on what is formerly known as the Wiener property, off-state in Blackbrook Roads in Aquinnah. It's going to have about 250 electronic gaming machines. They want to have a beer and wine bar, but they haven't yet applied for a permit from the town, and they plan to have food trucks and outdoor seating as well. So all things considered, it's about, you know, they've been clearing 4 acres of land out there, which in a small kind of normally sleepy town is seen as a lot of construction work.
And there's been concern about the traffic of trucks on the road that this has created already.
Yeah, the selectmen in their meeting last week were sort of lamenting the presence of these dump trucks that have been driving down State Road. They were saying that, one, it's a safety concern, and then, two, they don't know anything about the timeline for construction, so how long are these trucks going to be driving around? Now, I talked to the town administrator this week, and he said that the trucks have stopped, but construction has continued. And that there are a lot of moving pieces, and he doesn't really have any idea what to expect or where they're going from here.
Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for bringing us up to speed on that.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, voters at Chatham's May town meeting will have a new zoning bylaw amendment to consider, one that allows the creation of accessory dwelling units. A lot of people, both for and against, are viewing this as a big deal. Tell us what this is and what the intention here is.
Sure. Well, the Planning Board has spent months refining this bylaw before they voted to support it and submit it to the Board of Selectmen, who voted to support it and put it on the warrant this past week. Now, officials say that this bylaw is going to be another tool they can use to help ease the housing crunch here in town. Chatham, not only are the prices of houses quite high, but the number of available rental units is pretty small, and there's hardly any turnover. So the goal is to try to create small rental units within single-family homes, which would be available to, you know, young people, older people looking to downsize, that sort of thing. It's really to create a more diverse selection of housing in town. Now, this bylaw would only allow up to 20 of these essentially apartments to be built within existing single-family homes that must be occupied by the owner on a year-round basis. 10 of the units would be allowed by right, that is without any sort of special permit. while 10 would be reserved for properties that have dimensional or other problems that don't conform to the zoning bylaw. Those would require special permits. The units must be rented on a year-round basis, and owners must file annual leases with the town. The units are limited to 900 square feet and two bedrooms. And proponents acknowledge that this bylaw isn't going to create affordable housing. The town already actually has an affordable accessory dwelling unit bylaw, but under that provision, there have been no units created. So officials think that if you take off that affordable requirement, units will be created that will be more or less market rate, although the size limitation will probably limit the rental prices of those units. Now, there are a number of people who have criticized this bylaw as being flawed, and some people feel it will result in abuses with second homeowners trying to create units and renting them out either on a seasonal basis or as being Airbnbs or something like that. Town officials, however, say that they believe there are enough checks within the provision of the bylaw to prevent that type of situation. But they acknowledge that it's not a perfect measure, and they did build in that limit of 20 units per year to prevent any sort of widespread abuse if that were to happen. And they also say if that's the case, then they can revisit the bylaw and close any loopholes or amend anything that needs changing. And as we know, zoning bylaws require a 2/3 majority at town meeting to pass. So we're expecting kind of a lively debate on this when it comes up in May.
Tim, before I let you go, I want to ask you to update us on the Monomoy Theater story. We talked about this over the last couple of weeks.
Sure. Just briefly, we learned last week after the company, a representative of the company that's going to be buying the property, Newton-based Alexandra Properties, met last week with theater supporters, and they basically decided that they would not be able to hold a season of plays this coming summer. They had hoped that they'd be able to do that, but the work that's needed to get the property into shape and the time limits that they have isn't going to make that possible. So unfortunately, the theater will remain dark this summer. But there's some hope that the new owners who plan to take control of the property on April 30th, that they will renovating the property, and they've said they plan to place it on the National Register of Historic Places. And there's hope that after that happens, the theater can reopen. That's been the stated goal of the people who are buying it, that they want to run this as a community theater and be able to have a summer program like has happened there since 1958. So unfortunately, no plays at Monomoy Theater this summer, but there's hope that they will return in the near future.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Bye.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Kristen, the town of Mashpee is moving ahead to negotiate an agreement for operating the town's only recreational marijuana facility. The company they've selected is already the operator of the Cape's only medical marijuana facility.
Yes, so the company they chose is Triple M, and they already own a medical marijuana dispensary at 29 Echo Road. And now this new go-ahead will give them the opportunity to negotiate a host agreement with the town for a proposed recreational marijuana facility near that medicinal shop. They got the go-ahead on Monday from the Board of Selectmen to negotiate a host agreement, and they're looking to construct a 3,700 square foot combined medical adult use facility at the location. Adult use really refers to the use of marijuana for recreational purposes. They were one of six companies that were sort of up for this spot. And the town really said that the decision to go with Triple M is based on the fact that they have a track record with Triple M, and that really made them comfortable moving forward. There was a screening committee that consisted of the police and fire chiefs and various town boards that kind of reviewed those projects and proposals. There was sort of one blip, though, in Town M's history, and that involved the use of pesticides at their growing facility. Triple M has been the only medicinal dispensary in the state to have been penalized by the State Department of Public Health for pesticide use. Their store was briefly shuttered in December after state health officials had issued a cease and desist assist order. While it was looking into those concerns at the cultivation facility in Plymouth, the use of pesticides is prohibited under state regulations. But town officials said that, you know, that Triple M has dealt with this issue. They dealt with it through the regulatory authority and that they're comfortable moving forward.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, a proposal for a major 40B housing development that's been very controversial has been before the Zoning Board of Appeals for quite a while. Time may soon be running out for them to reach an agreement.
It may. The Surfside Crossing 40B proposal, which is currently 36 single-family homes, 4 duplexes, and 60 condo units proposed on just under 13 acres. It started out as 156 total units, has been before the ZBA since last May. And this week at the most recent public hearing, developers said that they're hopeful that a decision could be made soon. They granted an extension to the ZBA to continue public hearings through April 4th, but ZBA members said they'll likely need more time than that to make a decision. And the ZBA, as with all 40Bs, is the only local regulatory authority that has any jurisdiction over the project. It's 40B is the state law that allows developers to skirt local zoning in exchange for building affordable housing in communities that don't have at least 10% year-round housing affordable. Nantucket has about 2.5% at the moment, so 40Bs are have been proposed over the years here on Nantucket. This is the latest one. It's been very controversial. Opponents, members of the neighborhood and other island residents say it's far too intense and dense for the site, that it will put undue strain on the town's water supply and sewer, and they would like to see the ZBA denied or certainly scale it back. Developers say they are trying to build not only affordable housing, but mid-level, moderate-income housing on Nantucket. Affordable housing is an interesting phrase because the cost of living is so high, the cost of real estate is so high here, that what is affordable on Nantucket may not necessarily be affordable anywhere else. They're offering these, say they'll offer these condos for between $450,000 and $750,000, which is a segment of the market that is not even available right now. The most affordable single-family home on the island right now is somewhere in the $750,000 range. So the ZBA is hoping to continue taking a look at this. If they deny it, or if they approve it with conditions not conducive to the developer, they can take it to the State Housing Appeals Committee, which in the past, not only on Nantucket but elsewhere, has been favorable to builders in communities like Nantucket with less than the amount of affordable housing they need. So interesting to see what happens moving forward here.
Other news there, an island conservation organization is hiring a weekend night police officer as it attempts to discourage late night parties.
It is. The Nantucket Conservation Foundation is going to hire a nighttime weekend police detail to watch over its property right now around Gibbs Pond as an effort to discourage would-be partygoers. This move comes after a large bonfire and fireworks were held at an impromptu party last Friday night that foundation officials say threatened not only the safety of those who attended, but the property itself. They around Gibbs Pond on Saturday morning when they went out to check the property, a large fire that burned throughout the night was still smoldering, and the fire department had to be called in to extinguish that. March is rather wet and damp on Nantucket, so they weren't too concerned. But as the properties start to dry out, as spring turns into summer, they're very concerned about the possibility of wildfires there. The foundation has about 9,000 acres of open space on Nantucket, and foundation officials fully acknowledge that one police officer at Gibbs Pond may just send partygoers somewhere else. But they said, again, out of an abundance of caution and hopefully to prevent anything tragic from happening on one of their properties, they have to take a stand and do this, and hopefully it'll discourage partiers from going out there. That property and other foundation properties have long been a popular spot for weekend parties by high school students primarily and other young people, especially in the summer.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Kristen, a group of community leaders and other representatives gathered this week to discuss the problems of litter and pollution on the Cape. This was described as a kind of summit meeting on the issue.
Yeah, so this was the second Clean Cape and Islands Summit, and it was hosted by Creating a Responsible Environment, otherwise known as CARE, for Cape and the Islands. And it was in partnership with the Center for Coastal Studies and the Cape Cod Anti-Litter Coalition. It was held on Tuesday in West Yarmouth, and it sort of brought representatives from across the Cape. And their goal is to develop a unified environmental stewardship message campaign, and they want to have that in place by this summer. So CARE for the Cape and Islands was founded in 2012, and its first summit was held last November. There, more than 50 people attended, and they shared challenges and best practices regarding plastic pollution, litter, and they established 5 working groups who came together again on Tuesday, and they talked about things like beach cleanups, cooperative purchasing, litter awareness and prevention. They identified the top 5 priorities that they're planning to target this year, and those are single-use plastics, carry-in and carry-out of trash, runoff, and aquifer protection, cigarette litter, and dog waste. Mm-hmm. So those are the things they're going to be taking on.
And one of the strengths here is that they were able to reach out to other groups, bring some groups together.
Yeah, so there were a whole bunch of people who were working on this. They're encouraging if towns and other groups are working on something similar, they can come out and pull them together so they can have a unified voice.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Casey, a fire on Wellfleet's Lieutenant Island this past week claimed the lives of 2 people. And it highlighted the particular difficulties for firefighters heading to the island. To begin with, this time of year, the population is so thin. A fire like this was a big fire. It went unreported for quite some time.
Yeah, that's right. It started late Sunday night on Lieutenant Island. It was the home of Ferdinand and Kathleen Crawl. 2 people died in the fire, and their identities have not been confirmed at this point. And anyway, the Friends of the Crawls, who are year-round residents, one of the few year-round residents on the island, are worried, very worried. So anyway, aside from the tragedy of these 2 particular deaths, the fire has raised a couple of issues, 2 issues that have come out of this. And one, as you said, is Lieutenant Island is a rather unsafe environment from a firefighting standpoint. It's separated from the mainland of South Wellfleet by a low-lying road and a bridge. The low-lying road is at the height of a marsh, which frequently floods. And the police chief, the fire chief, Richard Pauley, told us he doesn't allow fire engines to go on the island when the water floods the road. And that's because it's so dark out there at night. There are no railings on the road. The road is at the level of the marsh. So it would be very easy for the truck to drive off the road into the mud and tip over. There are also a lot of homes out there, actually, but it's very sparsely populated. And so the issue of not being able to, not noticing a fire is very real. And that's exactly what happened in this point. Also, the roads out there are, in some cases, not much larger than driveways, and they're potholed and not in great condition. And what happened on Sunday night, or at that point early Monday, was a fire engine got stuck in the soft sand and mud. The roads are also named, it's not funny, but it's just bizarre, the roads are named 4th Street and 4th Avenue, 5th Street, and then there's also 5th Avenue. So in terms of finding your way around there, it's pretty difficult as well.
Especially you can imagine in the dark at night, firefighters arriving to try to get somewhere and trying to figure out where to go with the roads that are misnamed. And many of these roads don't even have street signs, apparently.
Right. Don't have street signs. There's obviously no road lighting at all. So, it's very dark out there. And you know what? This fire also brought up that this was the 3rd fire in Wellfleet in less than 3 months. And in all 3 cases, the property, the homes, and in one case, a commercial garage owned by Easy Dozit on Route 6, they were all total losses, all completely destroyed. So it raises the question of what can Wellfleet do to become a safer community for fires? There's very little fire hydrants. I think one of the fires had fire hydrants available, but the other 2 didn't. Also, being that Wellfleet is so sparsely populated in the winter, these fires aren't getting reported until they are really far down and far in bad trouble. So hopefully the conversation will continue and something good can come out of this.
Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times, the agency that has operated Cape Cod's Head Start program for decades, is seeing major changes. It's no longer going to be running that program, for one, and it's planning to merge with another nonprofit.
Yes, so Cape Cod Child Development announced on Friday that it's going to be merging with the Hyannis-based Job Training and Employment Corps. And this decision came after the Office of Head Start decided not to award a contract for Head Start back to Cape Cod Child Development this year. Instead, it will award it on an interim basis to Community Development, Inc., and that will give Cape Cod Child Development time to sort of rebuild itself and run more efficiently. Cape Cod Child Development's $13 million budget annually included $3.1 million in federal grants for Head Start. But the program really was troubled. There was a report in October that came out that showed mismanagement of finances, severe understaffing, and a lot of problems just basically keeping the kids from biting and hitting each other. One child was left out on a playground alone for, I think, 30 minutes while staff didn't know that the child was out there. And what has been said is that there was a mid-January follow-up visit to Cape Cod Development, and it really showed that even though it's been working hard to correct these deficiencies, that there are still a lot of problems there. It's been taking steps to improve financial and managerial problems, but the deficit for 2018 was expected to be worse than it was in 2017, which was sort of when, you know, this report unveiled that it existed. And then also at the time of the follow-up visit, Cape Cod Child Development did not have a qualified fiscal officer in place. It still had several teacher vacancies, and it had failed to make sure that no child was left alone or unsupervised. During that visit, Cape Cod Child Development was actually having teachers undergo a training to make sure that July incident when the child was left alone on the playground didn't happen again. But actually, as they were training for that, a three-year-old was found unattended in the hallway of the West Main Street Center. So the board of Cape Cod Child Development said it's going to respond to federal officials with its objections. But right now, what they're really focusing on is making sure that Head Start can transition smoothly from Cape Cod Child Development to Community Development and make that as seamless as possible for parents and students.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And joining us on the phone right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. George, a special fair took place this week on the island, and this sounds like a really imaginative event. It provides high schoolers a chance to understand finances in a very interactive and close-to-home way. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Steve, this is the answer to that question. Where am I going to use that math, right?
Uh-huh.
it's sponsored by the Cape Cod Five. I believe they do this on the Cape as well, at high schools across the Cape. But they came to the island this week and gave students a little lesson in credit for life, really looking at the what their job would pay them. So they're given a job at the beginning and a salary, and then they meet all kinds of expenses like housing and car and all of the things that we deal with on a daily basis. And they kind of get a sense of how much money they need to do the types of things that they want to do. If they're going to have, you know, that sports car, or if they're going to, pay for a monthly subscription to something like Netflix.
It's a role-playing game where these
absolutely,
take on a role and then you move to these different stations where you find out what your expenses may be, right?
That's right. And in fact, we had an interesting sidebar. Lucas Storrs, who's one of our reporters here, he's a young guy. And so we had him actually do the Credit for Life fair. He got a job as a marine biologist. He knew what his salary was going to be. And he went through the exercise himself. And he came out quite well. In the end, he would have like $500 a month in discretionary funds. But it was interesting. You know, it's sort of like if anybody's ever played the game of life, they spin a wheel and, sometimes they get some unexpected expenses. And we all know what those are, you know. And Lucas, when he was going through, he had a medical issue that cost him, you know, $200. So it really does give them a little taste of reality. And at the same time, you know, they have a little bit of fun and get a little taste of what it's like to be an adult, which, you know, sadly for them, in a couple of years, they're going to be faced with all these decisions.
And let me ask you about another story you have this week. Lobster fishermen in our region, as if they didn't have enough challenges, are now pointing to a threat from black sea bass. And this is a fish whose population appears to be growing in our waters, in big part because of ocean warming.
That's right. When we were looking into this story, we had our fishing columnist was here in the newsroom that day, and we asked him about it. He goes out quite a bit, and he said, you know, when he was out fishing the Derby, you know, he just couldn't get away from these black sea bass. You know, he wanted the striper, he wanted the bluefish, but he couldn't get away from the black sea bass. He just put in a line, and you know, he'd be reeling them in. They're everywhere apparently, especially around the island, and it's causing quite a problem with the lobster fishery, especially. Apparently, they love lobster as much as I do, Steve. You know, they'll gobble them up whole. The lobster fishermen are, you know, saying when they throw back what they call the shorts, the lobsters that aren't quite ready, that they actually see some of these sea bass swallowing them whole. They've found as many as 5 sea bass in one of the lobster traps, just, you know, going to town on a lobster in there. So it's a real issue, and you know, one of the issues is this particular fish wasn't as prevalent here at one time, so there's not as many regulations here. So that's one of the things that they're trying to iron out is getting more regulations here on taking more of them and cutting down on the amount that they're eating in the ocean. So it's an interesting story, and I have to say, you know, before this week, not something that I paid a whole lot of attention to, but it is an important issue, you know, there being so many fishermen here on the island.
George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve.
With me from the Cape Cod Times, Kristen Young. Kristen, we've come to that part of the show in which we discuss the Dennis Yarmouth School District and the issues between the two towns. If you've been following along at home, you know that the towns have been struggling over how costs are split in the school district. There's a lot at stake to working this out, and quickly. Seems like we've been talking about it almost every week. Now the school committee has come out with a new proposal.
Yes, so this is actually pretty big news. The school committee has been working really hard over the past month to nail down and finalize this proposal for updating the regional agreement between Dennis and Yarmouth, which stipulates how much each town pays for things like construction and operating costs. It's something that the towns have been trying to do for years, but you know, weren't able to really get to a finalized agreement. And on Monday, the school committee did vote to go ahead and approve this proposal. It will still have to be approved by the state and by both town meetings, but it does offer some substantial changes, mostly that would shift some of these costs to Dennis. Yarmouth has sort of complained for years that they pay more than what their taxpayers should allow. They've actually filed a lawsuit against this new middle school that aims to stop this new middle school that was approved in December. It's a $117 million school. The district stands to gain about $44.3 million in reimbursement funds for the school, but only if they can sign a letter of commitment by April 11th. That's sort of the magic day there. Yarmouth has said they can't sign that letter of commitment if there is a lawsuit or a pending lawsuit against the method used to approve the school. People have said Yarmouth really wasn't suing because they don't want the school. It's more because of the regional agreement. And Yarmouth officials have since come out and indicated that they would, in fact, drop the lawsuit if the regional agreement can be approved by both town meetings. This proposal by the school committee is one that school committee members said doesn't include everything Yarmouth wanted on its list. It probably won't make Dennis super happy either, but they're hoping that the towns will be able to live with it. One of the main things that it does is fix the percentage for construction costs for any new regional school building, and that would include the new regional middle school if it goes ahead, to each town at 65% for Yarmouth and 35% for Dennis. That's more than what Dennis would pay if it was paying based on enrollment, but Yarmouth officials say, hey, there are things like the gymnasium and auditorium, administrative offices that you'd have to have regardless of enrollment. So dentists should be kicking in an equal share for that. The proposal also includes a stipulation that would require each town to pay 100% of the respective cost for renovations at Natticees Middle School in West Yarmouth and Nathaniel H. Wixon School in South Dennis. Those schools are both slated to be replaced if the new school goes forward. If they're not, they do need to be updated. Both towns have admitted to that. And the cost for doing so is more than $42 million for each school just to bring them in line with current code. So sort of that stipulation kind of throws down some, you know, we really want the school to move forward. Here's what's going to happen if it doesn't. The proposal also addresses operating costs. It would gradually increase Dennis's share of operating costs over several years, starting with a 62% share to Yarmouth, 32% to Dennis. For the upcoming fiscal year, that would increase about a percentage point a year until they reach an equal, permanent 65-35 split. And that wouldn't change year to year based on enrollment.
Now, you cover this for the Cape Cod Times. This is your beat. How different is this proposal from what they've been talking about in the past? They've had several iterations of how they can improve the PAC.
It's pretty different. This is the first time I've heard of a fixed percentage rate for covering operating costs and that wouldn't shift each year based on enrollment. They say they want to ease dentists into this because each half a percentage point could equate to as much as $500,000 for the town, depending on sort of the year and what the other funding formulas are. There's a lot that goes into this. The state also plays a role in terms of what it contributes. And also there's a base amount that each town is required to contribute that the state determines. This is really only what's on top of that. The idea also is that hopefully this will stop the practice of Yarmouth having to pay overrides each year just to fund its regular operating costs. That's happened for each of the past 2 years running. It's looking like that'll happen again this year for Yarmouth, although the amount would be significantly less if this new method of splitting the costs is approved.
The idea that all of this has to be resolved by April 11th puts a tremendous time pressure on this. What happens now? Is there an opportunity for selectmen to look at it and then goes to town meeting? What's the process?
So I'm sure the towns will take it up. The school committee has already secured a spot on each town meeting warrant for this to be placed as an article. So it's really going to be up to town meeting voters. One of the things Brian Carey, who's a school committee member, said is, you know, if that April 11th deadline passes and the lawsuit's still standing and we've lost the school, it's not likely that Dennis voters are going to come forward and support that. And that might be a motivating factor to Yarmouth to say, hey, maybe we've got this potential agreement going on. Would the lawsuit actually jeopardize the agreement? And vice versa, the agreement could. So it's going to be the who budges first kind of.
It is. And at the same time, people in Dennis expressing some feeling that they're really being held over the barrel by Yarmouth here, saying you have to agree to our terms or else we won't drop the lawsuit. So it's kind of on both sides. There's a lot of pressure here.
There is a school committee member, James Dykeman, who's from Dennis. He was the only one to vote against this. And he said, you know, he wants the new school to be built, but he likened it to, he said, I feel like we're making this decision with a gun placed to our heads. So some dramatic talk there, but hopefully they'll be able to work it out.
This week, some good news for the town of Wellfleet. Money for dredging Wellfleet Harbor has been included in the new federal budget.
Yeah, this is really big news for the town of Wellfleet. They received a notification this week on Thursday that $5 million will be included in President Trump's fiscal request for 2020. This is something that they've been trying to get done for a couple years, actually. This project was left off of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dredging budget for the past 2 years. But last year, the town kind of decided to take a different approach. They paid less than $5,000 to hire a lobbyist who's been lobbying in Washington, D.C. to influence Congress and the Army Corps. And that really seems to have paid off. An email that was sent to the town from that lobbyist said that, you know, again, this is really big news and that having this in the president's budget virtually guarantees that Wellfleet will receive that level of funding in the Army Corps plan for fiscal 2020. So again, a big payoff for the town in terms of that small amount they spent on this lobbyist. And dredging is really a big concern for many towns on the Cape, but also especially for this area of Wellfleet. In Wellfleet, the natural shoaling in this federal navigation channel, which is about 0.8 miles, and the anchorage basin has reduced depths and created navigational hazards during lower tides. Once the area is dredged, then it will also require that two areas around the town pier will be dredged as well. In 2017, town officials estimated that the entire job would cost about $20 million, although there is some possibility that there could be some federal or state aid for that. And at the time, the federal dredge was estimated between $4 and $5 million, and that's sort of still what the estimated cost is. The harbor is used by commercial fishermen, charter boats. There's a marina and other facilities that accommodate tourists and recreational water users. And it's sort of this deep silt in and around the pier. It's known as black mayonnaise.
Yeah,
it's not a nice term when you hear it.
It's descriptive, yes.
It is. It's very descriptive. They said it really poses a threat to the town's economic vitality.
The town of Yarmouth has some of the toughest tobacco laws on the Cape. It has been looking at a new ban around tobacco and nicotine, but now it seems to have backed off that.
Yes, yeah, so the town Board of Health held three listening sessions over about the past month, and it was looking actually like from what they had said, they might be looking to pursue these new regulations, but they decided on Monday that they wouldn't. And these regulations would have banned the sale of electronic cigarette devices and menthol, mint, and wintergreen tobacco products. Those bans are aimed at reducing the use of products by underage youth. And I think there are about three other towns in the state right now that have taken up the same bans. As you mentioned, Yarmouth already has some of the toughest tobacco laws on Cape Cod. They were the first in the state, actually, to ban flavored tobacco products in 2014. The town also bans the sale of tobacco products in pharmacies and has some other stricter regulations, too. They were one of the first in the state to increase the minimum age for purchasing tobacco products to 21, and the state has now adopted that change as well, but Yarmouth did it well ahead of time. So board members really seem swayed, though, at the most recent listening session on Monday by testimony from Dr. Michael Siegel, and he, oddly, is actually an anti-tobacco advocate who was arguing against the ban. Not what you would have thought. He's a professor at Boston University School of Public Health, and what he said is that these new bans could actually be harmful to adults who have quit smoking using combustible cigarettes using the aid of these vaping products. He said that he agreed, e-cigarettes are highly addictive. They contain harmful products, but he said there's no public health justification for taking them off the shelves and then allowing those more harmful combustible cigarettes to stay on the shelves. And then he also said that banning a flavor like menthol could really be viewed as arbitrary and capricious because there's no difference between a menthol cigarette like a Newport and a non-menthol cigarette like Marlboro, and that would just, doing so would be opening
the town up. Detriment to a health.
Yes, exactly. And that doing that, banning those would leave the town vulnerable to a lawsuit. So what he actually asked the board to do was to consider restricting the sale of all tobacco products to adult-only establishments, but the town said they're really not ready to take that step just yet. Retailers were certainly happy. The convenience store owners and gas store owners had come out over the course of these three meetings and said these bans would really hurt their business and that they wouldn't really be effective because people could just go to Dennis or Barnstable, where these flavor bans are not in place and they could buy the products there. But town officials did say, you know, it's sort of like you won the battle, but maybe not the war. There might be some stricter regulations, or most likely will be stricter regulations coming down the pipe. The town kind of wants to look around and see what's happening on a statewide level. They're paying close attention to a lawsuit against the town of Somerville, which was actually one of those three towns that I mentioned earlier that has already adopted a similar ban.
We have just about a minute left in the program, and I want to talk briefly about another of this week's articles marking Sunshine Week, which again is a national effort to draw attention to the importance of access to public records and open government. Great article by reporter Marianne Bragg about the impacts that reforms to the state's public records law are having for local towns.
Yeah, so the state public records law that would reform public record access went into effect in 2017, and now each town is supposed to appoint at least one records officer, or RAO, that's sort of like a one-stop shopping contact for anyone who's seeking public records. And town employees are kind of trying to take that and implement it, and some are saying that it's easy to respond to these are requests. Some are very time-consuming, and sometimes they just need more clarification on these records.
So now each town has a designated person. If you want information from the town public records information, there's a designated person, and they have a limited time frame in which they have to respond to requests.
Yes, they have to get these back to you in 10 days. They have 10 days to complete this. And, you know, usually it's someone like the town clerk, or it might be a department head who's appointed to do this as well.
I'm afraid that's our news roundup for the week. We could talk about that for a while. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to all our contributors today. We spoke to Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and we heard from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.